The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman is underwritten in part by Community Capital of Vermont, Green Mountain Power, The Alchemist Brewery of Waterbury and Stowe, UVM Medical Center, Burlington, Vermont, and by Let's Grow Kids, as well as nearly 700 VBSR business members who believe that sustainable business practices value people, planet, and profit.
Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. The Hidden History of Vermont. That's the title of a new book by Mark Bushnell. Mark Bushnell's name is familiar to many people because he is a regular writer. He has written weekly in the past for the Barry Montpelier Times Argus and the Rutland Herald, and now he writes a weekly column for VT Digger on history. He is the author of many books, including Discover Vermont, The Vermont Life Guide to Exploring Our Rural Landscape, and It Happened in Vermont, From the French and Indian War to the Exposure of Maple Corner, as well as a number of other stories. Mark Bushnell, welcome to the Vermont Conversation.
No, thank you, David.
So the book is a collection of many of your newspaper essays, is that right?
Yeah, I've sort of taken them in, you know, not on deadline, been able to polish them up and make them the way I wish they'd appeared the first time.
What got you into writing Vermont history and ferreting out these little stories?
Well, I studied history in college and went into newspapers. I worked for the St. Albans Messenger for a few years and then down at the Sunday Rutland Herald and Times Argus for another eight. And one of the things about writing for newspapers, it's a little frustrating because editors are all interested in the here and now. If you have a historical bent, it only can really come out if there's an anniversary. You know, it's got to be a 25th anniversary or 50 or 100 is even better. And so it leaves just a lot of stories you can't write. And actually, I think the reason that I'm drawn to those kind of stories is, unlike a newspaper story, you know how these end. I mean, with newspapers, you're always writing, you know, you put a new top on a story and then you're writing the same thing. I mean, newspapers are vital and they're kind of like your fire department. You need to have them there when you really need them. But, you know, day to day, sometimes it's a little slow. And
right.
With history, it opens me up to write about anything that interests me from Vermont's past. So there's a lot to work with.
Well, one of the things that I always enjoy about your columns and now the essays in this book is that while you may think you know the story, as soon as I begin reading one of your accounts, I realize I don't really know the story very well at all. So I think there's no better one to start off with than revisiting what you called the oversized confidence of Ethan Allen. So this is a, you know, a historical figure who looms large in Vermont history. But you have another take on Ethan Allen, a side of him that most people may not know. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, yeah, I mean, and before I start, I should say, you know, you have to give Ethan Allen his due. He was a great rallier of men. He really changed history. He made, you know, Vermont possible in a lot of ways. But he wasn't the kind of person you'd probably want to follow into battle. He was incredibly lucky at Fort Ticonderoga because the garrison at the fort had no idea that there was a war going on. There was one guy manning the gate to the fort, which was literally just a wicker gate they'd put up because the old one had just crumbled and fallen down. That guy pointed a gun at Allen's head, fired, and the gun didn't go off. So that was just the start of the luck, and that's sort of where the story ends with Allen. I mean,
this was a couple of weeks after the Battle of Lexington and Concord, and they didn't know that shots had been fired on Boston Common.
Exactly, yeah, news didn't get around. They had had someone, a Green Mountain boy, who'd been there, I think, getting a haircut at the fort and, you know, got the buzz that they didn't know what's going on. Made the job a little easier.
Getting a haircut as surveillance or intelligence.
Exactly.
Gathering.
Yeah. I mean, and the problem was that, even, you know, Allen's greatest victory at Ticonderoga could have gone the other way because they didn't have enough boats to get everyone over. They needed to take, like, I think, three trips to get people over there, and only a third of the men got there. So if they'd faced serious resistance, they would have been in trouble. People might not know that Allen officially shared command of that attack with a guy from Connecticut named Benedict Arnold, who went on, you know, infamously to become a traitor, but he was also a brilliant general. And you would have been better off following Arnold, because a few days after the fort gets taken, Arnold gets this idea, and he goes north on the lake and seizes a British sloop, a British warship, which had been causing problems, could have caused problems for the American cause. And Allen gets jealous. And as soon as Arnold takes off, Allen grabs all these guys. They don't get enough supplies. They start rowing. They meet Arnold coming south with the boat that he successfully captured. And Allen says, okay, you're going to do that? Well, I'm going to take St. John, which is up at the north end of the lake and, you know, across the Canadian border now. And they get there. They've got no food. They're exhausted. It's the middle of the night. The men just lie down and sleep. The British notice them in the morning and start firing cannon at them. And Allen lost, but no one got killed. They were quite lucky. But one or two men got captured, and other ones had to walk back to Ticonderoga because they didn't get back in the boats in time. Hmm. And Allen had an even worse time. He tried to seize Montreal and with a very small group of men and without orders to do so, and ended up getting captured and spending, what was it, more than, I think, the better part, two-plus years as a British captive.
Hmm. What is a bit of uncovered history that has surprised you, that you've come across?
Oh, wow. I mean, so much. I like you, I didn't know these stories going in either. You know the basic outline, maybe, if you're lucky. But, another one from the same time period, a little bit earlier, in the 1750s, this is back before the Revolution, the British and the French were fighting, and the British sent this guy named Robert Rogers, Rogers Rangers, you might have heard of. Hmm. And they have this great reputation, but as these, you know, hardy sort of Green Beret type guys. But they were sent to attack the Abenaki village in St. Francis, just north of the Vermont border. I'd heard of that attack, and he claimed that they had killed, you know, 200 Abenaki, and I'm sure in his telling it's, you know, all braves and, you know, but in fact it was, the Abenaki said he killed more like 30, and then they looted the place because there'd been a Catholic mission there. They stole all this silver and these candlesticks and a silver statue of Mary, and they fled. They immediately got followed by a group of French soldiers and Indians, and Rogers decides to break this group. He had 140 men with him. He decides to break it into 11 different groups and just flee back to where they came from, which was Fort Crown Point on Lake Champlain. But they get pursued. They run out of food. They think that they're going to, be able to hunt enough game along the way. Some get killed, and some turn to cannibalism.
You're listening to the Vermont Conversation. We're spending this half hour with historian Mark Bushnell, whose newest book is Hidden History of Vermont. It is a collection of his historical essays that listeners may have read in the Times Argus, Rutland Herald, or VT Digger, where he now writes weekly. Mark, tell us about hiking before hiking was a thing, which also relates to the founding of Norwich University.
Yeah, I mean, this story is really about Alden Partridge, who's a really unusual character. He was born in Norwich. His father had been a Revolutionary War veteran. He himself went to Dartmouth and then finished up at West Point, where he became the superintendent in 1814, a rather important position. He annoyed some people because of changes he made in the curriculum. He got fired, and to show how stubborn he was, he showed up the next day for work as if nothing had happened. They decided that they were going to...
Is this like Roy Moore losing the election but just refusing to acknowledge that he lost it?
There are sometimes parallels in history,
sorry,
yes.
I just had to work Roy Moore into today's show.
And he ended up getting cashiered from the Army for insubordination. He comes back to Vermont, but doesn't let this failure get him down. He ends up forming what's now Norwich University, and it's so named because it was in Norwich. And he had a strong belief that hiking really created character in his cadets. I think they probably wish he didn't have that feeling, because he was such a gung-ho hiker. I mean, he decided to hike Mansfield and Camel's Hump, which doesn't sound like a big deal, but if you're starting from Norwich and decide to do it on foot,
and
it's a long
no
way
to go. And there's no trails on the mountains yet, right?
No, he's bushwhacking, and it rained most of the time. It was a 150-mile round trip. His journal is amazing. I mean, he just seems to have such good spirit about, like, soaked to the bone, oh well, you know. Oh, and when he's up there, he takes his barometer and he estimates the Camel's Hump is 4,088 feet, which is only 5 feet off of what we say today.
Wow.
So, but, I mean, he would go on these incredible trips. He took a 300-mile round trip to Massachusetts. On one of those days, he walked 84 miles. His advice to young men was to walk 10 miles per day at a rate of 4 miles per hour about three or four times each year. Shoulder your knapsack and your barometer and ascend to the summits of our principal mountains to determine the altitude, walking from 30 to 80 miles per day according to how you can bear the fatigue.
Hmm.
So you can imagine what the cadets must have been like.
Hmm.
Pretty hardened people. Oh, and another interesting thing about him is how his story goes on, because a guy named James P. Taylor was inspired by him, created the Long Trail. The Long Trail, in turn, inspires Benton McKay to create the Appalachian Trail, which now runs from Georgia to Maine.
Hmm. All this from the guy who founded Norwich. If you listeners have any questions for Mark Bushnell, the historian, questions about arcane little bits of history you've heard about or myths and rumors, feel free to call him and ask yourself, 244-1777 or toll free 877-291-8255. You write in here about Vermont's first strike. Tell us about the strike.
No, well, that happened, because Vermont was sort of not on the cusp of the Industrial Revolution, but when we finally had sort of an industrial size workforce, it was when we were putting in the railroad in the 1840s. A whole bunch of Irish laborers had come over fleeing the potato famine. They came via Canada and came down, and railroad representatives would go up and hire them. And a whole bunch of them settled in Bolton Flats, which, you know, mm-hmm. right along the interstate in Route 2, in areas which were then nicknamed Cork and Dublin, after the cities in Ireland. And some of them had families with them. These were real communities. And putting railroads in was really dangerous work. So it was hard to get the guys to be very excited about it when they weren't actually being paid. So when the paychecks didn't come on July 1st, 1846, they marched to Jonesville to confront the railroad manager was there. And he said he couldn't pay him because the main contractor hadn't paid him. And that contractor said he hadn't gotten paid because the Central Vermont Railroad hadn't paid him and, in fact, owed him $200,000, which is a heck of a lot of money 150 years ago. So there's sort of a hostage situation takes place. They seize the contractor and say, we're not going to let him go until we get paid. And they block the road from Montpelier to Burlington and just wait it. The sheriff shows up trying to arrest everyone and has to withdraw because he's way outnumbered. And they end up calling out the Burlington light infantry. And the strikers see them coming and take off. A few get arrested. Some get jailed briefly. And the Burlington Free Press, who was, you know, no friend of organized labor, still said, these poor men earning their daily bread from the sweat of their faces, and they ought to be paid, which seems fair enough.
Hmm. Now, these days, Vermont is known as a fairly forward-thinking and progressive state, but you talk about women's battle for the ballot, for the right to vote. And Vermont was not leading the charge on this. What happened?
Yeah, no, I'm glad you bring that up. I mean, I think that's one of the ways that these stories sort of illustrate the hidden history of Vermont, and because we like to see ourselves as so open-minded. But in the 18th, there are two stories, actually, that relate to women's efforts to get the vote. In the 1870s, a bunch of famous activists for women's suffrage came to Vermont. Julia Ward Howe, who's better known for writing the Battle Hymn of the Republic, Lucy Stone, Mary Livermore, and William Lloyd Garrison. who had been a champion for abolition, all arrived. And they were in Vermont because they were trying to rally people to, because we had a constitutional convention coming up, and they were trying to change the state constitution because they thought Vermont was a good place where you could do this and you can go state by state. It was before there was a national push for the women's rights to vote. At the time, by national standards, Vermont women actually had more rights because they could sue for divorce on the grounds of adultery, intolerable severity, or non-support. But still, once married, a husband was a legal guardian of his wife. They pushed the promoters who came into the state weren't exactly treated very friendly. The newspapers called the women harpies and Amazons. At a meeting in Chittenden County, someone threw hot pepper on the stove, which created sort of a primitive form of tear gas and cleared the room. Hmm. Lucy Stone was maybe one of the bravest of the suffragettes who came up, and she said, "Let me talk. I can't be thrown off. I read from a script. They could throw chairs at me, and I'm going to keep going." Like, luckily, it didn't come to that, but it also, when it came to this time to vote at the state convention, the delegates voted 231-1 against allowing women the right to vote. And perhaps not coincidentally, the reason they might have voted against it is because all of them were male.
Hmm. How much longer did it take for women to get the right to vote?
Yeah, they didn't get it. I mean, they started getting in earlier in municipal elections and things. But it didn't come until 1919, and Vermont had the chance to become the deciding vote. If Vermont's legislature had voted in favor of it, women, it would have been the deciding vote. But unfortunately, Vermont's governor at the time, Percival Clement, was afraid of giving women the right to vote because they opposed him politically on his favorite issue, which was about prohibition. He was against it. Might have been because he was a hotel owner that sold alcohol. I don't know. But he was so feared that Vermont would be the one to put them over the edge that he got a call to go and meet down with Congress, and he had to make a deal with his lieutenant governor not to call a special session of the legislature because the lieutenant governor was in favor of women's suffrage. So they struck a deal so there wouldn't be that vote when he was in D.C., and Tennessee got the honor of being the state that put us over the top.
Hmm. So Senator Joe McCarthy, famous anti-communist kind of leader of these anti-communist witch hunts of the 1950s. Vermont had a role in pushing back against McCarthyism. What was it?
Yeah, well, I mean, we had... I was going to point to another side. I mean, we did have a problem in that there were a lot of... a lot more opposition to... buying into the whole... anti-communist hysteria first. I mean, because there was a retired U.S. representative, Charles Plumley, who was a Republican from Northfield, who called for school books to be censored because he was afraid that people were slipping in these messages, pro-communist messages. And then the state legislature, I'm sorry, the state teachers group said, well, name some of the books that you think should be censored, and he couldn't name any.
Hmm.
But there was also a UVM cancer researcher who was fired because he couldn't answer questions, or he wouldn't answer questions about whether he'd been a member of the Communist Party a decade earlier. He ended up getting a letter of reference from a guy named Albert Einstein and became a major cancer researcher in New York State.
Now, the senator at that time, Ralph Flanders, sort of had a role in bringing down McCarthy. Can you just sort of remind us what Flanders' role was?
Yeah, I mean, Flanders was, he had gotten there as a, he was an industrialist and from Springfield. And he's not the kind of guy you would think would take on McCarthy, but he said that the real threat to the country was McCarthy himself. He argued that McCarthy that communism posed a danger to America, he agreed with him, but it was international communism, he was pointing out, that was led by Russia and China. That was the real threat, and that exaggerated claims of communist infiltration into this country was was actually harmful to the country because of the attacks on civil liberties and such.
And Flanders introduced the vote, the motion to censure McCarthy by the whole U.S. Senate.
Yeah, exactly.
Which
yeah.
Passed. Flanders and the other U.S. senator from Vermont, George Aiken, joined 20 Republicans and 45 Democrats in voting against McCarthy. That line leapt out at me because as we talk about some of the kind of overreaching and insanity in national politics, it's considered almost unthinkable that you would have this kind of bipartisan rebuke of a part of a leader, political leader, who was out of control.
Yeah. I mean, I think maybe times were different in that you had McCarthy going after Republicans, too. I mean, he wasn't the nicest guy to Eisenhower, President Eisenhower at the time. He supposed Eisenhower after Flanders pushed his resolution, Eisenhower supposedly joked to his cabinet that McCarthyism had just become McCarthywasm.
Well, I suppose it's only appropriate as we are riding our first big winter storms that you have an essay called "They Saw Gold in White Slopes." Of course, there were not white slopes in Vermont all that long ago. How did we come to be the ski capital of the East?
Yeah, it sort of came spontaneously. It happened in Stowe and in Woodstock at around the same time in the early 1930s. There was a lumberman in Stowe, forgetting his first name.
Craig Burt,
right. And he said, oh, people are going to think I'm crazy, but I think we could make money by, you know, having people ski. And people actually did write into the, it was a letter to the editor he wrote, and people responded, yeah, I think you are kind of crazy. But, you know, the CCC came in and did a lot of work at Stowe and at the, to create, you know, the first slopes. People were hiking up hill and skiing down. If you were really fit, you might get a half dozen runs in. And that was the complaint that some Wall Street types, actually, they got a lot of grief, but they were skiing in Woodstock and staying at a local farmhouse, and they were, you know, massaging their sore muscles at the end of a long day, and they said, gee, it'd be great if we could figure out a way to get uphill. So they talked to the innkeepers and said, you know, we'll pay you money if you can make this happen, you know, by next year. And this couple went, and I mean, this is in the days before Google. I don't know how they found it. They figured out that someone had rigged a primitive tow rope, the first one in North America, in Canada. And they heard about it, and they got the plans to figure out how to do that. And this couple, Robert and Elizabeth Royce, created this this device that was run off an old tractor. And they were able to haul people up the hill and...
This is in Woodstock.
In Woodstock. Yeah, Queechy, actually.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think that's 1934, and, you know, the CCV is clearing trails in Stowe only the year before.
Do you have a favorite story of the many that are included in your book, Hidden History of Vermont?
I don't know. It's hard to say because, I mean, these really are a diverse group of essays that grew out of my sort of eclectic interest. I mean, they're all interesting to me because I'm the one who pursued them, so I wouldn't say there's a favorite, but I mean, I've got, I'll just name one, looking at the arrival of cars in Vermont. I mean, we're, in 1898 was the first time anyone owned a car in Vermont. I mean, it was such a bizarre thing that this car, which was steam powered, people considered it such a threat that by law you had to have a person walking ahead of them an eighth of a mile warning people, and at night that person had to carry a red lamp. And it was just a really different time. That was the guy who owned the first car was a Burlington doctor, and a second Burlington doctor named Horatio Jackson got famous for driving cross country for a cost of, I think it cost him $8,000, which was, you know, low six figures to do that. But when he totaled up the cost of that trip, he had to add another $6 because that's the cost of the speeding ticket he had to pay for breaking the speed limit in Burlington, which was 6 miles an hour.
Okay. Well, on that note, if you're looking for a gift for folks for the holidays and you have somebody who you know loves kind of quirky, offbeat, and just interesting history, I heartily recommend Mark Bushnell's new book, Hidden History of Vermont. And Mark, thanks so much for joining us on the Vermont Conversation.
Well, thanks for having me, Dave.
That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at VermontConversation.com or on our podcast page, which you can subscribe to on iTunes. I'm David Goodman. We'll be back next Wednesday at 1 with another Vermont Conversation. Thanks for listening.
The Vermont Conversation with David Goodman. This special feature from Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility is underwritten in part by Let's Grow Kids, a statewide campaign about the need for more high-quality, affordable child care in Vermont to better support our children, families, communities, and economy. By Community Capital of Vermont, providing equal access